have the last couple of weeks especially been trying to focus on photographs of the walls of Jerusalem itself, since that's what Nehemiah's book is uniquely about in among all of the Bible books. This that you see right here is a picture I took in 2017 of what is the southeast corner of the Temple Mount. We'll have more to say about that in just a minute. But I wanted to say again, raise your hand if you did not get one of the handouts, this chart. Anybody? Okay, so you will have that now to be referring to. But so far, after our introduction last week, we saw in the first four verses of chapter 1 that Nehemiah, through his brother, learns about the state of the wall, that it is destroyed and that the gates are burnt. And he immediately goes into mourning. He immediately begins fasting. And he immediately begins praying. The first chapter will conclude with verses 5 through 11 and this tremendously insightful prayer from Nehemiah. Jesus' prayer, what sometimes referred to as the Our Father or the Lord's Prayer, depending on who you talk about, is frequently and properly referred to as a model prayer. But there are others, not a lot of others, but Nehemiah offers us one, Ezra offers us one, Daniel offers us one, there's some from Moses, wise for us maybe to mark those passages, make a list perhaps somewhere in a blank Bible page, prayers in the Bible, and you can research those. But here, in recent months at least, we're now seeing our third very personal, very desperate, but also extremely effective praying. So we looked at that last week, verses 5 through 11. We come then into chapter 2, and in the first 8 verses, Nehemiah will risk his life, reminiscent of Esther, whose lifespan is in the middle of the years that are covered by the book of Ezra, risks his life to seek the favor of the king, and grand favor that it was. Freedom to return, freedom to rebuild, authority in letters to conscript lumber, for instance, for this building. And so he is a man who has been the most trusted official, perhaps the single most trusted official in all of the Medo-Persian Empire, cupbearer to the king. And now he's able to go home for his first time to see what Jerusalem really is, this capital city of God and the temple location of the religion that he's tried to be faithful to throughout his life and even from such a distance. He is granted permission to go, and so he makes his journey, and in verses 9 through 16 of the second chapter, inspects the wall by night. He goes with one animal to ride upon, though he does have some other people who are on foot with him. They inspect this wall, apparently because he anticipates the opposition that he'll write extensively about in the future chapters. And so he inspects this wall, discovers that it is a terrible pile of rubble. The enormous task lies ahead. Even the beast of burden that he's riding upon can't pick its way through the rubble at one point. He has to turn around and just come back. But so, in verses 17 and 18, it must have been a pretty tall order. He's the new guy in town. He's only been in town for 3 days, as a matter of fact, when he makes this night journey. But now he's got to convince all of the people who've been living there for decades, some of them now, he's got to convince them that this monumental task that has been defeating them while staring them in the face every single day, it needs to be accomplished. It's time to step up and get it done. And so he convinces the Jews to build. And in verses 19 and 20, in those last two verses then of that chapter, the first, I guess it's not the last two verses, the 19 and 20, the first opposition to building arises. Now, if you'd like, you can write in the margin maybe of your Bible. I'm going to list these for you, and I'll identify each one as we come along. And you'll get an outline later of them in this lesson. But this is the first opposition to the building. Let's take a look at that in chapter 2, verses 19 and 20. I guess it is the last two verses of the chapter after all. It says, when Sanballat the Horonite And Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard about it. They mocked us and despised us and said, "What is this thing you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" So I answered them and said to them, "The God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem." So the second chapter ends with Nehemiah just simply standing up like any man ought to and telling this individual very much to his face and very plainly exactly where everything lies. And so let the games begin. The two have confronted each other. This first shot's been fired by Sanballat, and Nehemiah stood there and he didn't so much as blink. Said, "Okay, I accept the challenge, apparently, but I'm not going anywhere. Now it's your move." And so we have the rest of the book, or much of the rest of the book, which is in the third chapter, this building of the wall itself, and then some more history and events that will be taking place in that same time frame. So, chapter 3, we looked through it last week without reading it, because it is just a list of who did what. And this wall, then, is a tremendous task, but if the people have a mind to work, then, of course, they can get the work done. Now, to help us appreciate, because apparently it's one of the major purposes of the whole book, to appreciate what they accomplished in such a little time. Let's look again at just this wall right here. This is just a very small section, the end section, the southeast corner of the Temple Mount. So I'm standing right here, you know, just looking up at the top right there into an area which up on the top is forbidden to non-Muslims, but that little window there is occupied by Muslims to this day. They have no idea what goes on in there, you know, but they are. But what I want you to try to focus on is this one stone that you see now bordered in red. That is one stone right there. All these millenniums later, it's got quite a crack in the middle of it. So this is me standing by that same stone to give you an idea of the scale of the walls that Herod the Great would build long years after this. Herod's going to be building 400 years later. This is not one of Nehemiah's stones. But look at the size of this thing. It's 42 inches tall by 17 feet long. That's one big rock. It helps us at least to appreciate that the building projects of old were monumental. And so while Nehemiah's efforts at the beginning and back in 444 BC are not so grand as this, nonetheless, that stone will help us to appreciate the size of what was going on. This Temple Mount area, though it was smaller at that time, and this end of it didn't exist yet, because Herod built all of that part, 46 years have I been building before, building even before Christ was born. But if you look very carefully at that corner down there, there's that rock. Can you see it? I'm going to flash it again for you right there. There's that stone. See that little red box right there? That stone's 42 inches tall, 17 feet long, probably 42 inches wide too, but it's buried in the wall. That's where I was standing in the preceding picture. Now, what I want to do right here is to show you then the side view one man has constructed of what this would have looked like in Jesus' time, but note the various colorations which are showing different periods of time when building was taking place. There's that stone again right there. So in the picture I was showing you, this is the section we were looking at. I'm showing you about that much. In the time of Jesus, it may have been perhaps even twice as tall as what you saw a moment ago, and perhaps as much as 200 feet tall. So once again, trying to get back to Nehemiah's day is why I'm doing all of this. Here's another view of that corner. There's that rock. See that red dot right there. Now, this is a Muslim construction. The Ophel is this region in this area right here, which has recently been excavated and ramps and stuff put in. This is the very steep slope of the Kidron Valley. And right here is the area of King David's palace. What I'm about to show you are the known stones of Nehemiah's construction. That would be underneath this tarp right here when this particular photograph is taken, but just immediately right there. Right there is how it looks. So that in Nehemiah's day, try to ignore these stones, and you can see a kind of a natural line through here. These are kind of a different color. See how this corner kind of stands out from the rest. But these are stones that were placed in 444 BC at the order of Nehemiah, despite the opposition of the surrounding Gentile and Samaritan nations. This is the construction that we're talking about, and the ever so tiniest little bit of it. Where I was standing, the rock I showed you is right there. I was looking, at the wall from that side. What we're talking about right now is the side of this step stone structure I showed you a week or two ago. So right here is where we have no stones from the time of Nehemiah. The entirety of this, if you just measure from the wall at the north end of the temple down to this point here, what looks like the tail of Florida, is roughly about 3/4 mile long. It's maybe 1/5 mile wide, at its widest point. And Nehemiah is building all of these walls around here. He is building them with stones that are at least, we're only looking at higher ones in what I just showed you, that are at least so large that few men would ever be able to pick one up by themselves. And then, of course, very much larger. What we saw had been exposed. The lower stuff would be bigger, and it's still, all these ages later, underground. Maybe one day it'll be excavated. But that's the project. This was Jerusalem in the old days. Mount Moriah, here, also called Zion, where the temple itself was just rebuilt thanks to what two prophets getting the people moving? Haggai and Zechariah, okay? And that under a governor who led the first return from captivity. His first name begins with a Z. There's his last name, his name. Zerubbabel, okay? That part has been built, but right now it's smaller than this illustration you see, and that area right there is about all that Ezra's done. The men who had seen the original temple were weeping. This set of photographs I've got here, are of placards, displays about the walls of Jerusalem. And so I took some photos there that gives you an idea of some of the equipment that would be used. And what I'm going to do, this is the original picture. I'm now going to show you a close-up of this, and then we'll look at that and show you a close-up of the upper part right here. But I just want you to see that they were capable of handling stones that were huge in antiquity. Look at the pyramids, for instance, which were, in existence long before Moses got there. And so they have tools, they have levers, they understand physics, they figured out pulleys. They just need an awful lot of manpower in order to create something that can withstand the forces of surrounding enemies, all of whom really hate these people. So, to bring our chapter 3, up to a little more full than I had time last week, and also to bring it to an end, here's a map I found in one particular commentary that gives us, again, this outline that we've just been talking about. Here's the temple complex itself. Nehemiah chapter 3 is the most detailed description of Jerusalem in your entire Bible. So the next time you're looking at it, try not to just brush it off as being, you know, dry and boring and what matter, you know, is it to us and all of that. And I agree. We're not living in those times. We're not involved in all of that. But God in heaven decided there should be an entire chapter to record this event. And as a result, you know, it is obviously a profoundly important moment in Jewish history, but it will always stand as a great example for us. That was an amazing engineering feat in all of world history, what they've accomplished. And we get the most information, Old Testament or New, about, you know, the plot plan of Jerusalem than you do anywhere else in history. So if you happen to be counting, there were 10 gates that are mentioned, and gates are mentioned more often than anything else. The gates, of course, would be your ingress and egress, but they are also the least defensible, or maybe I should say the most vulnerable, you know, part of a wall. They're subject to being burned. They're subject to battering rams. So particular attention is always going to be paid to those gates. So 10 of those are mentioned. And what happens is we are told first about the sheep gate up here, which would be just about, you know, half past noon on your clock. And then in a counterclockwise manner, you are led through chapter 3, 10 gates, names of various people, several towers that were built, a broad wall, which is apparently a reference to a wall that had been built in King Hezekiah's time, so very long ago, 300 years before these people. And so this is chapter 3, God's presentation of the plot plan of His chosen capital city, the seat of the Jewish religion. As we've just read in chapter 2, verses 19 and 20 then, that's where three men play a principal role in trying to stop it. Let's defeat these Jews. Sanballat is known from outside the Bible to be the governor of Samaria at this time. An extremely famous papyrus called the Elephantine Papyrus, found in Egypt, mentions Sanballat at this time. So in this case, we have one of those uninspired corroborations. Tobiah may have been half Jewish. What do we call people who are half Jewish in Jesus' time? Samaritans. Okay. Not everybody who is half Jewish is a Samaritan, but you know, the idea is they had not remained within the bounds of God's laws with regard to keeping a bloodline that would eventually give us the Christ. Perhaps that's the case, but he too, we found not really a record of, but on the east of the Jordan River, his name was carved in a stone that's been found there. So these were very powerful men, very influential, as Nehemiah describes them, and also recognized in uninspired history. This Geshem, that's also going to be the third guy in all of this, was the governor of Arabia, which at that time included the region of the Edomites, whom you all know so well, from very ancient, you know, Genesis-type church history. So, with all that in mind now, let's go back and see, you know, if we can't develop an appreciation for what these people did. And see if we can't learn some lessons for ourselves in the process. What examples have they set? Why did God deem this so important that ultimately we'd have 13 chapters where Nehemiah, apparently, though some argue Ezra, as I mentioned in the introductory lesson, you know, is recording these events? If the world couldn't contain all the books to be written just about Jesus, well, why did God, some would say, waste His time telling us about this stuff that we have a tendency, I fear, you know, to just kind of dismiss? Well, we're going to start with chapter 4 now. After this initial building, Then, in or at least description of ongoing building, we have this in chapter 4 and verse 1. It came about that when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, he became furious and very angry and mocked the Jews. Now, back in verse 19 of the second chapter, this same Sanballat, along with Tobiah and Geshem, mocked and despised. But it does not say that they were furious and very angry. These men are beside themselves. We're in charge here. Who do you think you are, and what do you think that you're doing? So for a second time, this is number two if you're going to make your list of moments of opposition. This second time, he's going to mock them, only furiously angry. And he's going to enlist other mockers. So he does step it up. Earlier, you find these three guys mocking. Now, there's, you know, specifically in the presence in verse 2 of his brothers and the wealthy men of Samaria, he said, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Are they going to restore it for themselves? Can they offer sacrifices?" Apparently, that suggestion in mockery would be, look at how tragically weak, impoverished these people are. This bunch of homeless bums here has been camping out in the rubble all this time. Now, bear in mind, a mocker is always going to ignore the fact, what had they built? They had a whole temple up and running. Okay, but, you know, can they offer sacrifices? It sounds like he's saying they're too poor to have a bull that they can kill in sacrifice. Now, note mockery in its nature. Were they offering sacrifices? Well, apparently, since Ezra's dead. So, they'll lie, they'll minimize in the course of their mocking. And then he says, can they revive the stones from the dusty rubble, even the burned ones? Now, as a matter of fact, in conflagrations of that time and now, I asked the question of my brother who's been in the building trades for years, will the foundations, you know, in Paradise also have been destroyed by the heat, weakened by the heat, and have to be torn out? He said, yeah, probably will. I've seen the evidence of burnings of cities that we read about in Scripture. It says they were burned. You can see the stones to this day, and you can see the fracturing, you know, that takes place in this extreme heat. So, you know, this has all been destroyed. Can they do this? Well, you know the answer. What is the answer? Yeah, sure, you betcha. Okay, that's what it is. So in verse 3, Tobiah the Ammonite was near him, and he said, even what they are building, if a fox should jump on it, he'd break their stone wall down. What's Nehemiah's response? It's really sharp and interesting there. He doesn't even say, then Nehemiah. You know, it just says, hear, O our God, how we are despised. Return their reproach on their own heads. Give them up for plunder in a land of captivity. Do not forgive their iniquity. Let not their sin be blotted out from before you. For they have demoralized the builders. So we built the wall, and the whole wall was joined together to half its height. For the people had what? They had a mind to work. Brethren, you'll never find out what you can do until you have a mind to do it. I think one of the sagest, if that's such a word, things that I ever read in my life, that was an awful lot of years ago, and a publication that I was subscribing to that you know, was of a motivational nature. It was for businessmen who were building, you know, big businesses, but it was geared, you know, to give principles and advice, you know, along those lines. But the head of the thing, you know, the editor, the publisher, made the comment in an interview I had one time, never forgot it. He had come up with this saying, which was, and I quote, do the thing, and in the doing, you will learn how. That, I thought, one of the most profound things I ever did hear. And I've tried to practice that. There have been an awful lot of times in my life, and I suppose in your life as well, you look at a task and you just say, how? And as soon as you ask the question, it is actually a declaration of what? I am already daunted. See, already I'm thinking in terms of how difficult. How am I going to do this? And this man suggested that whether you know how or not, what should you do? Pick up a shovel and start poking around. Do the thing. And in the doing, you'll learn how. Well, these people had a mind to work. So they figured it out. They figured it out on the fly. And as you know well, they figured it out under much opposition as well. So this prayer, though, this tiny little prayer, brethren, in verses 4 and 5, I really do think you ought to mark this one. Is it not recorded by the Lord God of heaven for a reason? That reason has to be that He wanted even you, it's been recorded in Scripture all these years, He wanted even you to read those words and get something out of that. Did Nehemiah pray an appropriate, proper prayer? Did he pray a prayer that God would accept or reject? Ask us to emulate or refuse? It looks to me like he prayed exactly the way he ought to. Brethren, there are times when people's iniquity ought not to be forgiven. And the New Testament says that too in 1 John. Let not their sin be blotted out. They demoralized the builders. When people specifically set out to defeat God's people, they're not worthy of prayers of forgiveness in Nehemiah's book, which God caused to be written for us as well. So don't. Now in verse 6, so we built the wall. The whole wall, half its height. People had a mind to work. Now it came about when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, and the Ashdodites, Ashdod's a little coastal city far south, just a couple of miles north of the Gaza border today, when they heard that the repair of the walls in Jerusalem went on, that the breaches began to be closed, they were very angry, and all of them conspired together to come and fight against Jerusalem and cause a disturbance in it. Please note, if you're making such a list, opposition number 3. Third thing they did was to get together and plan an attack. They wanted to cause a disturbance. But in verse 9, what would you maybe even expect by now? Nehemiah immediately set about doing. We prayed to our God. Because of them, we set up a guard against them day and night. Thus in Judah it was said, the strength of the burden bearers is failing. Yet there's much rubbish. See, we're already worn out. We can't hardly go on, and there's much left. We ourselves are unable to rebuild the wall. Are they being demoralized? This is the third wave of opposition, and they are being demoralized. 11, number 4, fourth opposition. Our enemy said, they'll not know or see until we come among them, kill them, and put a stop to the work. So first they conspire to fight in number 3. Now they plan an actual attack, some sort of surprise attack, come among them. Verse 12, came about when the Jews who lived near them came and told us 10 times, they will come up against us from every place where you may turn. Then I stationed men in the lowest parts of the space behind the wall, the exposed places. And I stationed the people and families with their swords, spears, and bows. And when I saw their fear, I arose and spoke to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people. Do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord who is great and awesome. Fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. Now, brother, I guess anybody that's ever read this will notice, but it's been often pointed out, you know, even by strategic military planners and that sort of thing. Was that smart or what? Brother, I really love you.
But Bruce, I ain't going to fight nearly so hard for you as I would for Donna. No, I love you, man. I'm telling you, things get bad. You're going to be on your own. I'm going to go take care. That's not my wife. Where'd you go? There she is. I'm over there. That's what I'm going to do.
So what did Nehemiah do? He knows human nature. Well, I'm tired. I don't know how I can go on. Somebody's attacking my daughter. Now what? I'm suddenly the jolly green giant, aren't I? Only not very jolly. So he apportioned everybody in proximity to the homes that were along the wall. Then he had them come to work, grouping them as families. If something goes wrong, my wife and kids are right behind me. How hard am I going to fight? There will not be one fiber of my being that isn't fully involved in that fight. Right? Right. So, he's convinced they're coming. Fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. 15. Then, it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us that God had frustrated their plan. Then all of us returned to the wall, each one to his work. Came about from that day on, half of my servants carried on the work, while half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, and the breastplates, and the captains behind the whole house of Judah. Those who were rebuilding the wall and those who carried burdens took their load with one hand during the work, and the other holding a weapon. As for the builders, each wore his sword girded at his side as he built, while the trumpeter, see that would warn of an attack, stood near me. And I said to the nobles, the officials, and the rest of the people, the work is great, extensive. We are separated on the wall, far from one another. It may have been as much as a mile, maybe even a mile and a quarter from one north to south. At whatever place you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. So we carried on the work with half of them holding spears from dawn until the stars appeared. That time I also said to the people, let each man with his servant spend the night within Jerusalem so that they may be a guard for us by night and a laborer by day. So neither I, my brothers, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us, removed our clothes. Each took his weapon even to the water. Chapter 5. Now we get a little bit of an interlude right here. Chapter 5. Now there was a great outcry of the people and of their wives against their Jewish brothers. For there were those who said, we, our sons and our daughters, are many. Therefore, let us get grain that we may eat and live. And there were others who said, we are mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, our houses, that we might get grain because of the famine. Also there were those who said, we borrowed money for the king's tax on our fields and our vineyards. And now our flesh is like the flesh of our brothers, our children like their children. Yet behold, we're forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters are forced into bondage. And we're helpless because our fields and vineyards belong to others. Then I was very angry when I had heard their outcry in these words. And I consulted with myself and contended with the nobles and the rulers and said to them, you are exacting usury, each from his brother? Therefore I held a great assembly against them, and I said to them, we, according to our ability, have redeemed our Jewish brothers who were sold into the nations. Now would you even sell your brothers that they may be sold to us? And they were silent and could not find a word to say. Again I said, the thing which you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? And likewise, I, my brothers, and my servants are lending them money and grain. Please, let us leave off this usury. Somebody tell me, what is usury? What is usury? You got to be careful with that word. It's a fancy word. But if you go and you borrow money from a bank today, when you pay it back, you have interest. Now, usury is interest, but it's also a word that it carries with it the thought that it's exorbitant. It's the loan shark. And apparently, the guys who had the money were taking the fields and didn't care if you had to sell a son or a daughter into slavery. They were getting everything. Is usury permitted in Moses' law? No. It is expressly forbidden. Once again, the people are laying aside the law. Some are profiting, you know, by breaking that law. And Nehemiah is not going to abide that for 1 minute. So in verse 11, please give back to them this very day their fields, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses. Also the 100th part of the money and of the grain, the new wine and the oil that you are exacting from them. Then they said, we will give it back and we'll require nothing from them. We'll do exactly as you say. So I called the priests and took an oath from them that they would do according to this promise. I also shook out the front of my garment and said, thus may God shake out every man from his house and from his possessions who does not fulfill this promise. Even thus may he be shaken out and emptied. And all the assembly said, amen. And they praised the Lord. And then the people did according to this promise. Now, brethren, I grant you, Nehemiah has come from King Artaxerxes, his most trusted servant, with a lot of money and power. That is all true. But he is also how many men? He's one man. What typically happens throughout all of world history and in much of the world down to this day when one man opposes the will of the people? Short order, you have one less man, don't you? Murder has long been the way to solve that problem when the people don't like the orders that are coming down from above. So when Nehemiah does this, he must do this with such bearing, with both dignity and power. I wish I could have been there that day when I watched that man stand up and say, before the sun sets, you're going to give back all of that property. And everybody went, okay. Sounds like a good idea. This Nehemiah was a guy to be reckoned with, wasn't he? Now, you're talking about, you know, maybe vast sums of money, certainly a lot of property. And he just squared it that day.
They're also understanding that they're asking God to support them in this work. And they're in the middle of this work. And being pointed out to them that why should God support you because of this? So, I mean, it's not just Nehemiah, it's the standing behind him.
Well, Carol's got a wonderful point in both the prayers and in his speeches. Who does he say will build? God. Who does he say will fight? God. You know, who gave me favor with Artaxerxes? God. You know, so yeah, they see Nehemiah's a representative of Yahweh. 14. Chapter 5. Moreover, from the day that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year to the 32nd year of King Artaxerxes, for 12 years, neither I nor my kinsmen have eaten the governor's food. But the former governor, see the taxation that would come and be his wages. But the former governors who were before me laid burdens on the people, took from them bread and wine, besides 40 shekels of silver. Even their servants domineered the people, but I did not do so because of the fear of God. And I also applied myself to the work on this wall. We did not buy any land. All my servants were gathered there for the work. Moreover, at my table, 150 Jews and officials, besides those who came to me from the nations that were around us. So I'm feeding all these people too and not taking my wages. 18. Now that which was prepared for each day was one ox, six choice sheep. Also birds were prepared for me. Once in 10 days, all sorts of wine in abundance. Yet for all this, I did not demand the governor's food allowance because the servitude was heavy on this people. Remember me, O my God, for good, to all that I have done for this people. You suppose God was listening? Well, I guess. Now closes chapter 5. What has chapter 5 told us? If the people will not serve their God, when the people are out of line, what will Nehemiah do? In their faces, with a what? 8-hour deadline. And we're talking about all your properties that you took, you know, etc. And we have learned that he is one prayerful man, isn't he? He prays about everything. He succeeds in persuading these people, and then all he asks, remember me, all that I've done for these people. Chapter 6. Now it came about, when it was reported to Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem the Arab, to the rest of our enemies, that I had rebuilt the wall, and no breach remained in it, although at that time I had not set up the doors and the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent a message to me saying, this is opposition number 5, come, let us meet together at Kepharim, in the plain of Ono. But they were planning to harm me. Now, whether he knows this by inspiration or the people that live close by to them have gotten word of it, you know, I can't say, and I don't believe anybody can, but he figured this out. So in 3, I sent messengers to them saying, I'm doing a great work and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop? Will I leave it and come down to you? Now, brethren, skip back for just a second to chapter 2's last verse. How did the first opposition end? With Nehemiah saying in verse 2 of chapter 20, the God of heaven will give us success. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build. You have no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem. Now, with no portion, right, or memorial in Jerusalem, and you want an audience with the man who's responsible with King Artaxerxes' blessing and money to go ahead and rebuild these walls, you got time for such a guy that wants to interrupt the work? No. You going to make friends with him if you just say no? No. So, this plan isn't going to work. I'm just going to tell you, no. You don't have any part or parcel in this, and I'm not going to spend any time with you. So in 4, they sent message to me 4 more times in this manner. And I answered them in the same way. Brethren, this is fairly easy to get worn out if people just keep coming and keep coming and keep coming. We just finished the parables. We had a parable called the parable of the importunate woman. Who and what was this importunate woman? The one that what? Kept coming to the guy that wouldn't give her justice. And he said, lest she wear me out, what am I going to do? Give her what she asked. She'd been hitting me in the eyes, the literal expression. So 4 times, not work. 5. Then Sanballat sent his servant to me in the same manner a 5th time with an open letter in his hand. In it was written, it is reported among the nations, and Geshemu says that you and the Jews are planning to rebel. Therefore, you're rebuilding the wall, and you are to be their king according to these reports. And you've also appointed prophets to proclaim in Jerusalem concerning you, a king is in Judah. And now it will be reported to the king according to these reports. So come now, let us take counsel together. 6th opposition is the threat that I'm going to make a false accusation to Artaxerxes about you. I'm going to fix you. In verse 8, I sent a message to him saying, such things as you are saying have not been done, but you are inventing them in your own mind. For all of them were trying to frighten us, thinking they will become discouraged with the work and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. Now, I'm not going to get into details of this false accusation. You know, I had several different levels and all of that. But he understood what was going on. Brethren, in 536, when they started rebuilding the temple itself, in 536, did they face any opposition? And what happened then in Ezra's book? They wilted and neglected it. Nehemiah going to brook any of that? No way. He's just a man among men. So, I know what's going on. But look, brethren, what he says in the first part of verse 9, what he's thinking. What does he tell us he's doing in the last part of verse 9? He's praying again. Now, O God, strengthen my hands. 10. Seventh time. When I entered the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, son of Mehetabel, who was confined at home, he said, let us meet together in the house of God, within the temple. Let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you, and they are coming to kill you at night. Would it be in keeping with Moses' law for Nehemiah to go into that temple? Huh? But I said in verse 11, should a man like me flee? Could one such as I go into the temple to save his life? I said, I wouldn't do that to save my life. And you're trying to claim it's to save my life, but I wouldn't do it to save my life. I will not go in. Then in 12, then I perceived that surely God had not sent him, but he uttered his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Now, brethren, again, you know, we think of prophecy as a very formal thing, requires the Holy Spirit to come upon somebody, reveal a message they can't possibly know otherwise. What is a false prophet? Well, our first thought then is somebody who is maintaining that the Holy Spirit has come upon them and is revealing the mind of God, and therefore they are God's representative to tell people what to do. Don't think that's the way it's being used right here, though. So let's see who among you can dig really deep. Tell me what the word prophet, going all the way back to Moses' time, means. And do you have to be inspired to do it? What is a prophet? A mouthpiece or spokesman. Does that definition have to be followed with for God? No. False prophets wouldn't be speaking for God. But anybody that speaks for somebody else is a prophet in that sense. And I think that's the way Nehemiah is using it. He's this mouthpiece. He's claiming either divine or somebody else's, as if he had a message maybe from those who were threatening to kill, you know, Nehemiah. But, you know, prophesying they were going to come at night. Well, they weren't, and they didn't, and he caught him at it. He says, 12 in the middle, but he uttered his prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. So now I got a traitor. He was hired for this reason, that I might become frightened and act accordingly and sin, which is what it would have been if he went in that temple. So they might have an evil report in order that they could reproach me. What were they doing? They were setting a trap, weren't they? They were laying in wait. Let's see if we could get him to break Moses' law. Long ago, what did they do with Daniel? They set the trap. This guy prays three times a day facing Jerusalem. And the only way we'll be able to get him is through his religion. So let's pass along. We'll go to the king. Same thing. 14. What do you find Nehemiah doing? Remember, oh my God, Tobiah and Sanballat, according to these works of theirs, and also Noadiah the prophetess, the rest of the prophets who were trying to frighten me. So the wall was completed on the 25th of the month Elul in 52 days. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. How many concrete trucks did they have? What were they moving? Stones like the ones I showed you earlier. 16. Came about when all our enemies heard it and all the nations around us saw it, they lost their confidence. They recognized this work had been accomplished with the help of our God. Also, In those days, many letters went from the nobles of Judah to Tobiah, and Tobiah's letters came to them. Many in Judah were bound by oath to him, because he was a son-in-law of Shechaniah, son of Aaron. His son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshulam, son of Berechiah. That doesn't mean anything to us today, but obviously, you know, we got, you know, a bunch of nepotism ties going on here. 19. Moreover, they were speaking about his good deeds in my presence and reported my words to him. And then Tobiah sent letters to frighten me. That is number 8 and the last. Now, we'll recap in a moment. But look here at the first part of chapter 7, and then we'll bring all this to a close. Came about when the wall was rebuilt, and I'd set up the doors, and the gatekeepers, and the singers, and the Levites were appointed. I put Hanani, my brother, and Hanani, the commander of the fortress, in charge of Jerusalem, for he was a faithful man and feared God more than many. Then I said to them, do not let the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is hot, so later in the day, and while they're standing guard, let them shut and bolt the doors. Also appoint guards from the inhabitants of Jerusalem, each at his post, each in front of his own house. Now the city was large, spacious, but the people in it were few, and the houses were not built. My God put it in my heart to assemble the nobles, the officials, and the people to be enrolled by genealogies, and then I found the book of the genealogy of those who came up first, in which I found the following record. These are the people of the province who came up from the captivity of the exiles when Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried them away. I guess it must be whom. And who returned to Jerusalem and Judea, each to his city. Who came with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Azariah, Remiah, Nehemiah, Nehemani, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mizpareth, Bigvai, Nahum, and Baana. The number of the people of Israel. Now, brethren, we don't need to read the list. Just make the note at verses 66 and 67, and we'll be done. In 66 and 67, the whole assembly together was not 42,360. You would, of course, think so at first, but what does he do in the next verse? He then says, besides, and what's he do? Add some more. So I did the math for you. In your margin, you can write the grand total. After he had done the long list and then he added these at the end, there's 49,942. How many people are living in Jerusalem? Just shy of 50,000. Now, I have no idea. How many people live in Springfield? About that much? More even. I wish I knew. I should have thought to ask. Okay, at any rate, this assembly had a mind to what? They worked no matter what. They worked because Nehemiah knew how to see through all this, brethren. When they were opposed by mockery, Nehemiah meets it with his intentions. I'm going to do it anyway. The second time, we get more mockers. And what does Nehemiah do? He prays. The third time, they're conspiring to fight, so what does he do? Prepares to fight then. Fine. I'm not wilted in front of you guys. Fourth, they plan an attack, and what does he do? He shows even more force. Fifth, they plan an ambush, and then his wisdom and his courage are revealed. Sixth, they have a false accusation they're planning. He denies the accusation. Then they set up a slander against him and he proves himself faithful. And then in the end, they have these frightening letters. And we're not told a word about what he did there. What might you guess he did? Took care of it one of these ways. Okay? Because that was a man who knew how to do it. Go thou, brother, and do likewise.